Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Fulhamish podcast. My name is Jack Collins, and we are coming to you live and direct off the back of a dishevelled, disheartening, and frankly, extremely disappointing 3-1 loss to Aston Villa at Villa Park. And here to dissect that Midlands malaise, Mr. Farrell Monk.
Hello, friends.
Hello, Faz. And Miss Lydia Campbell.
Good evening, guys.
Evening, Lids. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you too. As happy as we can make it.
All right, we'll do our best to wade through the muck in some ways and get through that Fulham performance. Before we do so, Faz, do you want to start us off with some three-word reviews?
Yeah, I will do. A couple of them did make me chuckle as I was scrolling through them, and thanks for making us laugh on this.
We needed it.
A disheartening Easter Sunday. I'll start with FFC Lewis's on Twitter, which did make me laugh, where it's just, at least I'm drunk, with at least in one word, which, I mean, maybe he hasn't drunk enough if he's able to recognise that he needs to shorten down the words a little bit. It kind of reminded me of the whole Leroy Jenkins YouTube thing from many years ago, where he's like, at least I have chicken, if that's a reference.
That's a niche reference.
Very niche reference.
Keep going.
But yeah, so onto the more serious ones. We've got Frank Miller 05's Tomb Door Shut. Dan McGrath's Uno, Dos, Trezeguet. And finally, we've got TJ Frogs 46s with Trezeguets of Hell. Thanks very much, everyone. Those were some excellent submissions.
Religious iconography playing a key part today, as you'd imagine, given the festival we stand at. I mean, let's get straight into the game, Lids. And it's just one of those things where Fulham were in the ascendancy, I would say, for around 65 minutes. We didn't necessarily create massive amounts of chances, but you'd say that we had a reasonably firm grip on what was going on, and then it just absolutely capitulated.
Yeah, I mean, similar to when we played City a couple of weeks back, that, you know, we'd done really well, nice and solid, and then next thing we'd concede 3 goals. Only this time, it was much more unexpected. We're 1-0 up, but at one stage before we'd scored, it came up on Sky Sports that we had like 10 chances and 5 shots on target. I was a little bit surprised at that, because while we were fairly solid, we didn't exactly look like we were, you know, battering the Villa goal. But, you know, it's such a frustrating one. When we go 1-0 up, we really have to go and try and get goal number 2. If there's anything we can learn from today, that's it. We absolutely cannot be sitting back, because unfortunately we're not that good when it comes to that style of play.
Well, we used to be, and perhaps, Faz, this is kind of the point I'd like to come on to, in that Parker today, and Scott Parker's got a lot of credit in the bank for Fulham's improved performances, you know, towards the back of February, in February, the back of January, and rightly so. He was given rightful praise for those things, but perhaps deserves criticism today. And Liz puts it there that, you know, we weren't very good at sitting on a lead, but what actually we did today was we sat on a lead without changing to the system that we used to sit on leads. We just sort of froze and did nothing. And that for me was more surprising than the actual inability to sit in it. Either add some energy and impetus and go for it, or draw the bolt, bring on the fifth defender and use that system. We didn't park the bus, weirdly, in a game that perhaps we should have.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was readying up the Scott Parker the bus GIF for some of the Insta stories today, and it just didn't happen. It was a bit out of character. And what kind of disappointed me more so was Villa were obviously getting a lot of their openings from crosses from wide. Admittedly, in that second half, Traore turned it on and he was incredibly effective and he was playing brilliantly and opening doors and creating chances from the wide positions. And we'd seen it throughout the game that a lot of Villa's chances were coming from those wide positions, and we were caught out on quite a few occasions. And it was just a bit of luck that Areola wasn't really tested a huge amount from those. We saw it pretty much straight from the off when Watkins, one fell at Watkins' feet and he didn't react quickly enough. But there, at that point, for that one, there were four Villa attackers in the box versus our three defenders. And that did happen quite often throughout the game. And you would think when we do go 1-0 up that we would start to recognise those. And we did have a couple of warning shots across the bow before the equaliser and we didn't react to it. And that just does seem very uncharacteristic of a Parker side that we have come to know over the past sort of 18 months, 2 years or so now. So, yeah, it was very disappointing that we didn't do that. And, you know, we kind of did the opposite in a way that we did actually start to, when we went 1-0 up, we were trying to sort of gain more openings as well, but we weren't really creating really decent shooting opportunities. And eventually we were caught out from the wide positions. Originally, Traore makes a position out wide. He does, I think it was a crossfield ball to Matt Target, who finds Mings down the line, who plays it back in, and it was a nice, smart finish from Trezeguet. But yeah, it would be silly to think that it wasn't coming after the goal. I'm just a bit annoyed because of that, the nature of it, that we didn't shut up shop. We had the warning signs there for where the goals were going to come from against us, and we didn't learn from it, and it bit us. It bit us hard, and we're feeling that this evening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Lids, you mentioned there the City mistakes, and I think that's interesting. We saw another. I mean, there's no real mistake for the first goal. It's a good finish. It's a well worked overlap. But the second goal is a mistake, and you can say that it's a little bit shoddy for the third as well. So when you look at that, and you look at four big mistakes in the last three games, or maybe five if you add Joachim Andersen's against Leeds United, that's five goals we conceded that Fulham just weren't conceding a month and a bit ago. We looked solid. We looked like a team full of confidence. That started to slip, that mask. That's a huge worry.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of making us look back to how we played at the very beginning of the season. Not quite as bad as that. You know, some of those performances were absolutely dire. But, you know, the worry is that over the past couple of games, we have handed goals to our opponents, which we absolutely can't afford to do because we don't score enough at the other side. You know, you have teams like Leeds, for example, who are pretty abysmal at the back, but they score, they outscore their opponents so often. We don't have the ability to do that at the minute, whether it's because we can't quite find the right recipe going forward, whether it's we just don't have the right personnel there. You know, we can go into that at a different time, but it is so important that we hold our concentration. And today was an example of someone trying to play out when he maybe just should have booted it. And it's a bit of a shame that it's tossing and it's in the same day that is, he had an interview this morning about how much, you know, he seems to be a real thinker. But it is frustrating. You know, it is expected at some stage whenever you're playing like that, when you are trying to play out from the back. But I mean, we weren't even, you know, he was halfway up the pitch. It's a really awful, awful time to concede possession. It was poor, and I can understand why he looked absolutely devastated after it, because that, in that moment, you know, that's the moment for me that we threw away the game. It wasn't the equaliser, and it wasn't the third goal, it was the second. And it was so avoidable, which is what's so frustrating about it.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair enough. I mean, come on to the attacking side of things. And Faz, I'll start with the positives. Obviously, Mitrovic has come back off an unbelievable international break. And he's broken his club scoring duck as well to put us into the lead. So that's the good news, right? We've seen Alexander Mitrovic looking sharp, and said to Lids just before we came on to the podcast, you know, yes, he takes advantage of a mistake, but I'm not sure that Mitrovic, out of form and out of confidence, has, you know, the nous to go round the keeper and slot that home. He maybe panics, he maybe hits it first time. And the fact that he, you know, looked at that opportunity, he was sharp enough to get to it and put it away, has got to be a good thing.
Yeah, and I suppose that his footballing brain reacts to it and probably makes up for any sort of pace disadvantage you may have. And, you know, this is a striker clearly in form, and he showed the confidence to be able to round Martinez and slot it home. A bit close to my liking to Mings with his finish, though. But we saw it straight from the off, really, and it kind of reminded me of that West Brom game away when it was his first start in a long time there as well, and it looked like why have we not played him all along? And it was a performance that kind of reminded me in the sense that, you know, he started brightly, he caused lots of problems for the opposition and had a couple of shots early doors. Talking about today as well, that pretty much the same thing happened. He had he was wrestling at the back post for a header. He had a shot near post that was saved smartly. And he had the pick of the bunch was probably the left-footed one, which I think is a better save and a better shot than probably the commentators give credit for, really. But after that, he was largely quiet. But I just don't think the game really suited him that well. And I think Fulham were guilty of overplaying rather than hitting Mitrovic quicker. And I think that was probably to his detriment. And he was being a bit starved of the ball a bit more. But I think if we're talking more about the attacking sense, I think a lot of credit needs to go to Loftus-Cheek and Declan Dover-Reed, in particular the former. Ruben Loftus-Cheek in the first half was exquisite and was central to a lot of the good play that we were seeing, and was Agreed. Reminded me of the Loftus-Cheek that, you know, easily got into the World Cup squad 3 years ago. He was in that, from that central position, he was so strong and at getting ahead of opposition players. Some of his touches were quite frankly world class, and just eliminating their his markers with just one simple touch, one little dropper of the shoulder here or there, and he consistently did it throughout the game. That was until I think that when after Cav came on, Cav operated from the left hand side and was doing very much the same thing over and over again. He was sort of like trying to sort of fake down the go down the left and try and cut it back inside and try and get an angle from there, and it didn't quite work. And I think after a little while, Cavallero then went more centrally, and then Loftus-Cheek went out to the left. And I've got to say that it really stifled Loftus-Cheek's play, and he was largely ineffective. As we have said quite often on this podcast for the last 3 or 4 months, that as soon as you move him out wide, he disappears from the game, and he's just not as effective. And I think today was probably one of the biggest indications of that. But, you know, overall, for literally the first half particularly, I was quite happy with our attacking play. But after the first half, we weren't really as potent, especially when Lookman came off. And, you know, we got the goal and we were starting to get a bit of steam. And then obviously Villa started getting their attacking side in order. And yeah, it was all downhill from there, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of link up between Loftus-Cheek and Mitrovic in the first half, Lydia, was exactly what we've been asking for. In many ways, we thought that might work as a 10 off a striker who's willing to hold the ball up, who's going to feed the ball into him. And I thought they linked up really nicely. I thought they both dropped off second half, but Faz makes a good point in that there was less to work from when players don't have to quite worry about Ademola Lookman's trickery.
Yeah, I mean, it's look, Loftus-Cheek's definitely better in that 10 role than Zambo. Like, when they put Zambo in there at the Leeds game, like, it didn't work at all. It is, you know, we've all known that's his favourite position. One thing that I would say about Mitrovic, and it's more of a worry than anything else, is that while he started very brightly, he had a couple of early shots. One where he tried to chip the keeper from inside his own half, which you're kind of like, what on earth is going on here? But it shows you the kind of confidence that he's on. One thing I would say, though, is that even the goals he scored for Serbia, the majority of them were like, they were brilliant strikes, but they were kind of all him in that, you know, he was maybe taking a shot that wasn't expected. He that chip against Ireland, for example, so apologies, Jack. It was absolutely superb. Some of the other goals he scored were from quite far outside the box. And what I would say is that it's not really the basis of any football format. That it's not that he scored all those because they were set up for him to do that. It's because that it was the only way he could actually get a shot, because he wasn't getting any delivery other than that. You know, that there's nice link-up play, as you say, between him and Loftus-Cheek. but it wasn't really ever resulting in a chance, which is why he's having to swing a bit, you know, from maybe 25 yards out to try and catch the keeper unawares, like he did with Martinez maybe in the first couple of minutes. You know, so the worry for me is that we're not actually creating any chances for him. We're relying on his own kind of brilliance to find his own way. And yes, you need a striker who can do that, but we cannot completely rely on that. We absolutely can't. I'm worried, and you know, we have been all season, that while we are putting some excellent deliveries in, Lookman's corners in particular are very good, we are just not, we're not creating enough clear-cut chances, which is why we're struggling to put the ball in the net.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty reasonable. We kind of forget about it in the madness of what happened in the second half, but Fulham very nearly went in to the break one down. Villa were awarded a penalty that was later overturned. Close call. I think we've just about got this one right. But you can understand why the referee gave it on first look, Farrell.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't even think it would. I wasn't even going to bother watching the VAR, really. I just assumed at first glance, I was like, well, that's a definite penalty. You know, it was quite sloppy from Lamina. But I mean, a lot of credit for creating that has to go to Ollie Watkins, unfortunately, as a Brentford, you know what, you know, although made in the Southwest, made in the Southwest at Exeter, though, I'll caveat it with that. But yeah, I mean, thank the Lord for the first, you know, for one of the rare occasions that VAR has come to our rescue, because as soon as those replays started happening, I was like, oh, all right then. It did take quite a lot of replays, and the right decision was made in the end. But yeah, it did take a long, long time, and that turning feeling in the stomach was slowly unknotting as more replays were given. And you kind of know it as soon as the referee is called over to that TV that it probably will be overturned. But it was so tight, you know, a tenth of a second a bit later. Lamina reacting to that, and it's a stonewall penalty. But yeah, it was a little bit sloppy. You can hear as soon as he gets the ball, player shouting at him. I couldn't quite make out what they were, but yeah, but it was probably along the lines of what I hear on a Sunday league every week. Get rid.
There's a couple of things that I want to touch on before we move on, Lids. One of them is a masterclass, and we've got to give credit here to Dean Smith in terms of proactive substitutions. You know, it goes back to what I was saying about Parker earlier. But Dean Smith brought on Keenan Davis, went 4-4-2, brought on Trezeguet, who scored twice, and Jaden Ramsey, who did really, really well in the middle. So funny, I've seen a couple of tweets from Aston Villa fans saying, not sure what Jaden Ramsey does, but we're better with him on the pitch, which I think is a really interesting capacity. But actually, you know, what Dean Smith did today was he made the changes that changed the game. And it was only after the goals went in that Parker reacted. And that's a worry, I think. And we talked about this with Thomas Frank last year in the first game back after the COVID-enforced break, right? In that the game was 0-0, Fulham were in the ascendancy in the game, and then the changes were made and Parker was reactive, whereas Frank was proactive and he swung the game in his team's favour. We've seen another example of this today, and I've praised Scott Parker for learning from his mistakes. We saw a slip back into bad habits, I thought, today.
Yeah, I mean, look, this game was won and lost on the basis of the substitutions. I think the vast majority of us can agree on that. You know, the subs that they made were very bright. Ours, unfortunately, were not. I mean, okay, obviously, Lookman came off
injured. Yeah.
So aside from that, because I didn't think Cav was that bad. I mean, I think...
But he worked hard, but was poor.
Yeah, he works hard. He's much better out wide than he is in centre. But the two subs that he then did make, I mean, that Onuma decision was a very odd one for me. You know, for a fella who hasn't really even played that much recently at all, when you have Zambo on the bench, it's just a little... Look, it was unusual for me. I was kind of, to be honest, he's the last person I expected to see come on. Magic, I can understand that sub, but it just, you know, by that stage, the game was gone.
I thought it starved us. Loftus-Cheek coming off starved us, I felt, in some ways, of being able to hold onto the ball and build it up. And there's a reason that Fulham weren't able to hold onto it after the subs were made, because without Lamina and Loftus-Cheek, we completely lost control of the middle.
Yeah, the midfield battle was essentially completely lost at that stage. And it's so frustrating. You know, look, I haven't been Loftus-Cheek's biggest fan this season. I've made no secret of that. But he does do something that, well, Josh Onimer definitely didn't do when he came on. And then obviously we tried to play, I'm assuming, a different sort of system rather than have it, you know, we had Metro and Magic kind of in the same place and it just didn't really work. We left a massive gap in the middle. And it was a poor choice for me from Parker. What I will say is that generally he's been very good at, you know, learning from that. But it was, I mean, today, as I say, the subs, the massive contrast in the subs that were made were definitely where this game was won and lost. I would have liked a sub probably a lot earlier anyway, and not just reacting to the goals. Because by that stage we'd essentially thrown it.
Yeah, I don't mind if Parker injects energy. I thought Olaena was knackered, absolutely shattered, and by the time the third goal goes in, he can barely stand up. I don't mind if Parker goes for his five at the back and Fulham invite the pressure on and then concede, because Parker believes in that system, right? And we've been proved time and time again wrong that he's been able to do that when he's gone five at the back and seen games out, right? And do I like it? No. But has it worked over the course of the last 2 years? In the majority, yes, I think is the truth of the matter. And so if Parker had made that decision to dig in and go five at the back and try and shore it up, it would have been uncomfortable, but I think we would have at least been like, he's done something to try and influence the outcome of the game. Now, if he'd injected legs and we thought we're going to go for it and go for the jugular and score the second, fine also. But it was one of those ones where we were like, make a decision either way. Don't sit in the middle and leave the team out there who are knackered by all accounts to then go and sit on. And a bit of a damning stat to Anderson, Matt Roberts tweeted me that he said, we've gone up now at West Brom, Sheffield United, Newcastle United, Burnley and Villa, and we've won zero of those games. That's not going to keep you in this division, Faz.
Yeah, and especially when you sort of like look at the fact that we tend to name quite defensive benches. I mean, that's probably down to the fact that we don't have a huge squad with a lot of talent running, especially attacking talent running through it. You know, but you look at the bench today, Brian was there, Zambo Anguissa, Kongolo and Anthony Robinson and Tim Ream. So that's, you know, five of the plethora of subs that are available to Scott Parker, and not one of those actually came on today. And we were in the lead for I don't know how many minutes it was in the end. 17 minutes it was.
17, yeah.
And at the tail end of the game. And it does feel a bit, like I said before, a bit uncharacteristic from Parker. He has changed that kind of what was a winning formula last season. I mean, granted, it's a totally different league. It's completely different. There's different situations and whatnot and different styles of play and all this sort. But, you know, you're looking at all those players that are available to them. And maybe there's a trust issue here with those players, because I run back through those, and apart from Robinson, have we seen any of those defenders at all, you know, especially recently? Ream, we haven't seen.
Kongolo, actually, like, I'm still not completely sure that he's real.
To be fair, he was the best player on the pitch away at QPR and at the FA Cup game.
And then he went off injured.
Yeah, and it's... But they're named on the bench for a reason. They must be available, but we haven't seen a single minute of those other players at all. So maybe there is a trust issue. And like you said, Aina was definitely knackered. I don't know how much he played in the international break. But I mean, Zambo Anguissa, I don't think he played that much over the international break. I think he only played but one game. But yeah, I mean, no defensive substitutions in 17 minutes at the tail end of a game that you're winning 1-0 when wins are so absolutely vital right now does feel a bit naive.
I would completely agree. Right, that is probably enough of ranting about the Aston Villa loss. We're going to move on to the second part, where we have the exclusive audio from an interview between Alan Shearer and Scott Parker. We'll see you after the break. Welcome back to the Fulhamish podcast with me, Jack Collins, Farrell Monk.
Hello, everyone.
And Lydia Campbell.
Hello.
Right, we've got some exclusive audio. That's exciting. It's very exciting. And this was Alan Shearer, Premier League's top ever goal scorer, talking to Scott Parker face to face, well, over a Zoom call, as everything is these days, about, you know, this season as a whole, Fulham, his managerial career. And I think the first bit we should start with was Alan asking Scott on how he's finding this season back in the top flight.
Can you enjoy it, Scott? I mean, you're able to enjoy it, you know, you're not getting results. So I know it's a huge relief when you get results. Can you enjoy it because of the position that you're in?
I enjoy certain aspects. I don't enjoy losing. Regarding the league table, I've never been a weight on me. That's never been something which I've been solely took massive focus on, because I knew where we would be and I knew I'd have to be comfortable in this situation. And certainly I knew the players would have to be as well, because the realities are fourth last year, coming out of the Championship, a young team, a team with a lot of new signings and loan players. And they're not excuses. That's the cold hard facts and reality. And some of these players, most of them, have probably not been in and around the Premier League or certainly experienced it over a sustained period. So I knew there'd be some real struggles and how quick the players or these players could adjust. But in terms of the league table, no, I get frustrated and I get disappointed. And what holds always is maybe performance, or you don't feel things have gone your way at certain moments. But throughout it, I have enjoyed every minute of it. It's everything we worked hard for last year. And while at times we have been exposed or there's been areas which have been very disappointing, there's also been some massive improvements and massive parts, which, you know, it makes it worth it, really. So, yeah.
Alan then moved on to the battle at the bottom as Newcastle United, beloved of Mr. Shearer, of course, and Fulham look to maintain their places in the Premier League.
Certainly from the outside looking in, it's looking more and more like a shootout between Fulham and Newcastle, which which is difficult for me, Scott. I've got you and Stuart Gray, who's an old teammate of mine. You're an old teammate of mine. Stuart was my old neighbour at Southampton, and I've got Newcastle. So from the outside looking in, it looks like a shootout, doesn't it, between you two?
You know what, I honestly, of course it looks like that. I think people were asking me the question a couple of months ago, saying, is it going to be this? What's it going to be? And I remember answering the question saying, I don't really know. There's so many games left. We're getting to the point where we're starting to pan out a little bit. Saying that, I still believe that in this division, Newcastle, the same, us, you go and win 3-4 on a bounce, and you go and put a real run together. And all of a sudden, you just don't know in this division, certainly this year and what's happening. And of course, it looks more like that out there. But I also believe that.
This is an advertisement for BetterHelp, a portal for finding online therapy. How's your social battery right now? If you feel a bit drained or lacking enthusiasm to meet all the social commitments in your life, then that can be a totally normal thing, especially with things picking up as we head out of winter. I know that pretty frequently a weekend just doing a few chores and watching the football was about the limit of my energy resources, but therapy can be a place to help you gain the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your batteries. Contrary to popular belief, therapy isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. The overall goal is to empower you to be the best version of yourself. And if therapy is something you've considered, then why not give BetterHelp a try? BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. They'll match you with a UK mental health professional with a wide variety of expertise. There's no referral needed, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, giving you complete control over the whole experience. Fulhamish listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fulhamish. That's betterhelp.com/fulhamish.
A little tiny blip in a run, and I include ourselves, and we need to be very wary of that. And the same for Newcastle and where they're going. But yeah, it probably is going to be out of our feet.
Right, well, thank you to The Athletic providing that audio for us. And if you want to read the full interview, you can subscribe to The Athletic UK right now for £3.99 a month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. Go to theathletic.com/Fulham Pod for 40% off. Once again, that's theathletic.com/Fulham Pod. Guys, really, really interesting interview. Obviously nice to get the audio on here, but as a written piece as well. And I mean, obviously, Scott knows Newcastle as well, not as well as he knows Fulham, but he was a part of that squad, and I believe he won the Intertoto Cup when he was up there, a trophy close to all of our hearts. Faz, I thought it was quite an interesting one, just in terms of how his approach was discussed. And look, we've talked a lot about Scott's substitutions and that today, but I kind of just want to talk a little bit more holistically about what he was suggesting he was implementing as a manager.
Yeah, and when you're reading through it, and it is an excellent read, and I mean, I have fallen in love with Scott Parker over the last few years, and learning how he sort of ticks and what he does and how he's become successful is really good to read. And he comes across with a great amount of honesty, and we see that in a lot of his post-match interviews, especially today as well. And you know, to Michael Dawson said, I can't believe how honest he is and how open he is about what needs to be done. And that comes through in this article as well. You know, even, and it shows an experience, and it shows a maturity beyond his experience in the management game. And it shows, especially when he talks about, as soon as he got into the management game, he knew that he needed a mentor. He knew that there's an added side to the game that he wasn't used to as a player. And he knows that the game has changed. And he knew that without ever having managed a top flight team in the past, and being able to recognize those things without having the experience and getting the information from other people to implement his ideas and getting results pretty much straight from the off is remarkable in itself.
Lids, I mean, the article title is, well, basically says, Scott says, he's a very intense person. He's scared of failure. And that's what drives me. Now, like, I like the idea in some ways that Scott hates failing. Like, that's a good thing, right? You want your manager to crave success and crave winning with the team that you support. I am a little bit wary of the phrase scared of failure, though, because, you know, failure is something that we've praised him for learning from his mistakes and his failures. Being scared of it isn't something that I'm like, oh, I want you to do that. I want you to look at failure and be like, yeah, I can understand that, and I want you to move on from it and kick on. And there is bits of this interview that are a little bit like, you think about it and it feels very, very intense.
Yeah. I would agree with those kind of concerns, in that I know from my own kind of sporting background, and not to a particularly high level, I must add, but all through playing hockey, the main thing that was drilled into us from a very early age is that you learn so much more from a defeat than a win. It may sound a little bit cliched, but it is very true. I was part of a very good hockey team in school, but we used to win every week. We literally battered teams off the park. But whenever it came to the cup, we never won it, because all of a sudden we were playing against very, very talented players. We weren't getting that in kind of every week. And I remember learning more about those games than I did when we were beating Belfast High School 9-0. Do you know what I mean? Because we didn't learn from those. What I would say about Parker is that I understand where he's coming from. And I think what he means, I don't think he means he's scared of it in the sense that he doesn't know what he would do when it happens, or that he, you know, would freak out whenever it happens. I think it's more, not poorly worded, because that's, you know, he's a manager at the end of the day. But I think he more means that he just really wants to avoid failing at all costs.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's completely fair enough. Interestingly, Faz, there's a bit about here about Valentine's Day, right? And it says, and I'll read the passage, it says, Fulham hadn't won in 12 league matches, drawn 8 of those games, hanging in. There comes a point where hanging in isn't enough. Before their fixture at Everton, Scott told his players he still believed that they wouldn't still be there if he didn't. They believed too. They responded, winning 2-0. Then they drew at Burnley and beat Sheffield United. 2 weeks later, they beat Liverpool at Anfield. Like, we've just seen us lose to City, which was expected, lose a really, really topsy-turvy game to Leeds, which a lot of people saw as a must-win. We've just lost a game that we were in control of against Aston Villa, which a lot of people have seen as a must-win. I think maybe what's nice and something that we can cling on to in terms of hope is that Scott will look at all this and he'll be disappointed. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that he's going to look at that game today and think, oh, yeah, not much. I think he can look at the Leeds game and say we were probably not the better side and we didn't really deserve much from the game. I don't think he'll look at today's game like that. I think he will look at today's game as hugely missed opportunities and 3 dropped points. But he will look at the next couple of games and go, why not? And there will be that sense in camp that that Fulham are still good enough to get out of this, even after a couple of bad results?
The way you first described that whole sort of like, it gets to him and he's fully aware of the issues, and he'll go home and he'll think about it and all this kind of stuff, is like, do you remember the season we got relegated and Martin Jol was under, the first time around back in 2013-14, when Martin Jol was the manager and he was... They were talking about, are you under a lot of pressure? And he's like, no, I mean, I've got a nice life and I'm quite happy. It won't affect my life if Fulham lose too much. And he got, it was very, very different for a football manager to say that at the time. And rightly or wrongly, he got a lot of flack for that. But, you know, he didn't think that he cared and he didn't really care if Fulham stayed up or not. And now we've got a manager in Scott Parker in a real relegation battle. And he's doing everything completely differently. And you buy into that. And he talks about in the article about the mentality, as we banged on for such a long time about Scott Parker, how he talks about the mentality. And, you know, he says, I always know that I can control the mindset of the players and I want to sell how the story goes. And as you say, that I have that belief and it transfers to the players. And I feel that time and time again, it looks like this team under Scott Parker are going to go into a massive rut that they won't be able to get out of, and there needs to be a lot of changes. And then suddenly the we get a result that isn't out of nowhere, but it's a result that's quite surprising. And I'm not just talking about this season, I am talking about last season as well. There was the point where
the Leeds game at home,
that's exactly what I was going to say. We weren't playing our best. I'm not going to go back and remember what games were leading up to that.
We'd lost to Brentford at Griffin Park.
Yes,
and it was
exactly.
One of the worst defeats. We were hopeless that day.
And yet we played that game. We weren't the best team. We did enough to win that game, but Leeds were firmly on top for a lot of it. But we put in a performance that was good enough to win that game. And that's just one example. And we can go through his whole tenure and sort of pick out little moments. But you look at other teams where they've got vastly more experienced managers and they get into ruts and they just can't get themselves out of it. Much like Newcastle have been under Steve Bruce, for example. Much like Chris Wilder has been under Sheffield United. For large parts of the season, Sean Dyche with Burnley. Yes, they have turned it around and whatnot, and all credit to him as well. But that's a manager with a lot more experience. Parker, second full season as manager in the top flight. I think it's remarkable from him, and I don't want this to happen, but I do have an inkling that will Scott Parker want another go at the championship next season. If unfortunately Fulham get relegated, might he get pinched by a bigger club? Might a bigger club take a punt on him? I'd be thoroughly, thoroughly disappointed. I think that, as I've said quite on numerous occasions, and you know, from what I've read, what I've watched, and it shows in the results, it shows in the performances as well with the team, I'll be thoroughly disappointed if he leaves at any stage, let alone if we get relegated or even stay up.
I think that's fair enough, and it's a really good interview. Like, I mean, I've said this about four times, but it really is, and I really enjoyed it because it gave you that little bit of insight into the mentality of it and the ups and downs of it, and the fact that he just seems to be very steely. And look, I've criticized Scott today, and I think that I've criticized Scott on many occasions when I feel like he needs to be criticized, and I've praised him on other occasions when I feel like he needs to be praised. And I think the interesting thing is perhaps to him that, well, not that the us, but the criticism and praise, not from this podcast, but from all quarters, doesn't really seem to faze him. He has something that he believes in, and he kind of sticks by it. Now, does that mean that at times he could do things better? Of course it does. Like, it doesn't mean that he's perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think that Scott has earned his right to be at the forefront of this train, you know, to the end of the season and beyond, no matter what kind of occurs from here on in. And it's nice to have someone at the helm that really cares.
He did say after the game that he said that there were mistakes individually and there were mistakes that we made as a team. And I think the individual mistakes are, you know, for him, disappointing. And there's probably not much he can do to change that. But I think the ones that the team mistakes, I think he'll take those personally. And he'll watch the videos tonight. He'll get his analysis team on it. He'll learn what those mistakes are, and he'll weed them out straight from the off. And and talk, you know, he talks about how, like, you know, they have those team meetings all the time, and it's very, very difficult at Motspur Park, where the, you know, it's a great training ground, but, you know, he talks about how it is very old, as we know, and they don't have huge meeting rooms like you might see on All or Nothing Tottenham or Man City. So it is quite difficult. But as you've seen throughout the whole season, he has, even with those difficulties, been able to get his message across and learn from those mistakes. And I think that those team errors he makes today, I have no doubt in my mind, like we talked about earlier with the defensive mistakes and not stopping the supply and not defending crosses well, I'm absolutely certain Scott will know them. He'll swallow his pride and say, look, this is where we need to improve. And let's go work on it in the training ground. I think that he's got all of that facets in his game in terms of tactically, mentality, and also man management. I think he's got all of those. He's got, you know, all of those things to be a top manager.
All right. Let's look to the future like Scott then in part three. Welcome back to part three of the Fulhamish podcast. I'm joined by Farrell Monk and Lydia Campbell. Let's look quickly forward to the game against Wolves. They come thick and fast now, Lids, and we've got an opportunity to bounce right back. And there's a bit of sentiment on the timeline, I think, today that, you know, yes, there are going to be knockbacks. And today is a huge knockback in terms of morale, in terms of confidence, in terms of we've thrown away points from a winning position, but there's an opportunity to write that straight away, and that's got to be something to look forward to.
Yeah, that's one of the good things about the league this year, with the games being quite as staggered as they are. It means that we don't have that long before the next one. We also have the advantage of playing on the Friday night, which means that we could be out of the relegation zone. Yes, Newcastle would be two games in hand if that was to happen. But it doesn't matter. It's still that boost that you get, even in those 17 precious minutes today. It felt great. Yes, it was snatched away from us, but I think I think we have to use this as an opportunity. We're playing before Newcastle are. If we were to get 3 points at home to Wolves on Friday night, we're out of the relegation zone at least until Newcastle play again. And I think that has to be what we focus on. If you can put the other team under that kind of pressure, it completely changes how they approach the game. They might not actually come out and say that, but I would say that mentally it definitely does. Definitely does. If we go and we're outside the relegation zone by, you know, 10 o'clock on Friday night, that will mentally have an impact on how Newcastle play in their next game.
Right, they got a point today, Faz, in a game against Tottenham that a lot of people had bookmarked as a 0 points for Newcastle, that one. Annoyingly, they were quite good. You worried, or is this a case of a little bounce back and things will go back to normal? I mean, I know Tottenham haven't been very good of late and actually have struggled quite a lot across the park. So it's not like necessarily a result that defies belief. It's not a point against Man City, but it is a point that they'll have taken to heart.
Yeah, they. I wouldn't necessarily say, I mean, admittedly, I only watched the second half of it, and I'll base my opinion on that, in the sense that I didn't think that they looked amazing. They created more than I thought that they would, but, you know, they did concede 2 goals in quick succession, much like Fulham did today.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, and they probably should have conceded more after that. Just before that they scored, Kane did hit the outside of the post, and that was the turning point. And it will, they'd be buzzing off that, regardless of who the opposition are or anything, because they're such in a low ebb at the moment that any sort of sign of positivity they'll take on in and consume it for days. So this will give them a bounce. You know, I didn't think Spurs looked all that bright, and they've got their own problems as well. And Newcastle took advantage of that, which probably is something that Fulham have been slightly guilty of a lot of the season, actually, not taking advantage of wounded teams so much, apart from maybe that Liverpool game. You know, the worrying thing is that their talismanic players are coming back from injury. Alan Saint-Maximin was back on the bench today. I thought Willock was bright, and he did get a goal for his efforts. And, you know, they've looked blunt as well. going forward for a lot of it. Almiron is starting to sort of get his energy back as well, I thought. And he was appearing quite a lot on all around the pitch, actually, for large parts of those for that game. So that will sort of worry me slightly. However, I just, as Scott Parker said, we're going to go back to the interview, and what he said quite a lot of the time is, you know, he just worries about ourselves. He just worries about Fulham. If, you know, it's not about other teams around us, we just need to worry about our own performances and pick up points where we need to. And I think that's the most disappointing thing today. But I'm still going to curse if Newcastle pick up a point as well. So I was cursing it certainly when that ball went in for the equaliser.
Lids, let's look forward then to our game on Friday. What changes do you make? How do you start? Obviously, we don't know the health of Ademola Lookman, which is going to be, you know, obviously key to the way that Fulham set up. Do you change the system? Do we look at the defensive errors that have crept in over the last couple of games, added to Wolves' system, and go back to a five at the back? Do we look at maybe going two up top with Madjer and Mitrovic? Is there something the spot does here that we should look to bring things into our own hands, or is it a case of today's individual errors can be kind of eschewed and we move forward?
I mean, I would quite like to see what it would be like to have Madjer and Mitro on the pitch together for a proper period of time. Look, it might be a complete disaster, but I don't necessarily think it would be quite as bad as the complete lack of service Mitro's getting at the minute. I think if Lookman's fit, I think he should play. I think he's a funny one because he hasn't actually been that great recently. But I think he's the sort of player who can win a game in an instant, which is something that we massively need right now. I think the mistakes at the back, well, I'd like to think that we should stick with the way we've been playing, purely because if we change it too quickly, it might just unsettle things even more. I think if we were to make more mistakes again in another game, then that's when you maybe change it. But I wouldn't be particularly worried about the big mistakes we made against City, purely because of the way they play and they force you into those mistakes. But if you do what we did today and kind of hand Villa a couple of goals on a plate again, then that's when I'd be starting to maybe consider making changes there. But I don't necessarily think it's the right time for wholesale changes in the way we play. I wonder what it will be like having Madjer and Mitro up front together.
Yeah, I mean, but does that mean you go 4-4-2? Does that mean you go... Because part of me thinks that if Ademola Lookman is out, I'd be tempted perhaps, and I've been a huge advocate of going to four at the back, but without Lookman, I thought we looked a little bit turgid going forward. I'd be tempted to see if we could bring in a side that was sort of Robinson, then Tosin, Anderson, Aina, Bobby Deck, Cordova, Reed as that kind of right wing, right wing back hybrid, Anguissa, Reed, Loftus-Cheek, and then Mitro and Madjer up top, which kind of allows you to drift Madjer out onto the left if you do go 4-3-3 and pull him back into a front two if you do end up going 5-3-2.
I quite like that because it gives you the options then of playing more defensively if we need to. And, you know, I think Robinson is decent at that, you know, running up and down the wing. Bobby Deacon-Overreid has shown that he's, you know, so versatile and has probably had his best games from that position that this season. And then as you say, you can push Madjer out wide if we need to. But if it's an option of getting Madjer and Mitro up front together, I would quite like to see how that would work, as long as we can get service into them.
Farrell?
Listening to you guys talk about it, I kind of played with a few ideas in my head. One thing that came to my mind while you were talking was going back to the sort of wing back system with the Bobby Deck-Cordova-Reed from the right hand side, and that kind of like hybrid was just trying something a bit differently, in the sense that, you know, if we do play that, I don't necessarily see Aina as a out and out wing back. So if you are going to play that kind of wing back system, maybe going with Robinson. But because Robinson, admittedly, I don't think he's played that well recently, maybe just try and go with Brian, because you know, he is a natural winger and he has shown some quality from that area. And it does offer something a little bit different that perhaps the opposition wouldn't be prepared for. And then that kind of frees you up to play sort of, you know, those two up top if you wanted to go that way. Or you could play two behind Mitrovic with one with RLC and Ivan Cavalero as well. Because if you play, you know, we've seen what Cavalero can do from the left or the right, and we've seen what Cavalero can do from the center. But I think that if you play that kind of two behind Mitrovic, it gives him that freedom to sort of take up a position that, in an attacking sense, that whichever one that he feels most comfortable with. And if you play Anguissa alongside Reed behind them, then that gives that nice link in between the back line and the forward line. Because we haven't necessarily seen it as much recently with Reed and Lamina, I don't feel. As excellent as Reed is, he's pretty much undroppable at the moment, I haven't seen as much from Lamina as going forward as you would expect him, because we talk about how good his ball carrying skills are. It's kind of gone a little bit recently, and I felt like that there has been that link that's losing slightly, especially with Anguissa dropping to the bench, not playing in from a deeper role. But it would be quite surprising. I think all in all, considering the way that Wolves like to play, they almost predominantly play with wing backs. It might nullify the Wolves' attack if we just match them man to man and play five at the back in that way. But the sort of joker in the pack for them is Pedro Neto, who's a very, very good player. I rate quite highly. He'll float. I think that Espirito Santo will just say, okay, if they're matching us man to man, will Neto, you move to where the space is. And I feel that perhaps that our system will be too rigid with five at the back with the personnel that we have available to be able to match them if they decide to switch it up, which has probably been our Achilles heel a lot of the season.
Aye, indeed. Well, decisions for Scott Parker to make, not us. So we will leave those decisions to him, and we will be back on Thursday as we discuss another whole host of Fulham issues. But for today, all that's left to do is to name this pod file.
I would love to go for At Least I'm Drunk, but I think that Sammy might riot if we decide to name it that.
I agree.
So I'll have to go with, but it's obviously a very, very excellent choice from TJ, Trezor Gates of Hell.
Trezor Gates of Hell, indeed. It did feel a bit like that today. Right, let's go and try to enjoy our Sunday evenings. It's all that left for me to do is to say thank you very much to Lydia Campbell.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much to Farrell Monk.
Thank you very much.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been the Fulhamish Podcast. Thank you for listening as ever. We'll be back in the week. Take care. We go again on Friday. You wait.